everybody. Nice to talk to you again. I'm Henrik, and this is Red Ice Radio. We are based out of Sweden. We question, reevaluate, investigate, and inquire into all the things interesting and important. And we are, as always, glad to have you with us along for the ride. RedIceCreations.com, that's our website, and you have our full archives on RedIceMembers.com. You can sign up and give yourself or a friend a treat for the inquiring mind. We have vast archives on all things between heaven and earth, and sometimes we go down to hell as well. We go far and wide in our search for answers. Today we have Anthony Peake back on the program. He's just released the book A Life of Philip K. Dick, The Man Who Remembered the Future, and we are going to go into the origins of many of his fascinating stories that later became major motion pictures. But we're also going to talk about what might be at the root of his inspiration: neurology, drugs, alien experiences, precognitive abilities, and all kinds of weirdness. Welcome back, Anthony. Great to speak with you again. I hope you're doing well. It was only a few months ago since we talked, really, but it's nice to have you back. Hope you're doing well.
No, I am doing extremely well. I've been very much looking forward to this particular discussion because Philip K. Dick is somebody I've been fascinated both as a reader of his work and subsequently being somebody interested in Philip K. Dick, the man, and Philip K. Dick, the experience as well.
Definitely. A Life of Philip K. Dick, the Man Who Remembered the Future. I mean, I think as science fiction's authors go, Philip K. Dick is the preeminent one, if you will. So many of his short stories have been made into magnificent movies and everything else, and we have a lot to discuss today, Anthony. But why don't you tell us about Philip K. Dick, the man, a little bit first here, so we set the stage for those who might not know who we're talking about.
Certainly will. You know, Philip K. Dick is probably, as you rightly said, one of the most influential science fiction writers probably all time, I think, in that his science fiction is different, in that he applies philosophy, he applies theology, and very, very deep questions about the nature of consciousness, the nature of reality, the nature of how we know what we know, and how we know it, and indeed whether reality itself is a brain-generated illusion. So you will find in most of his work that he is fascinated by these subjects. And on top of that, his work has been hugely influential on so many people, and his fellow writers, but also filmmakers and lots of other people. For instance, a lot of people may not be aware of this, but there's even been an opera written on his novel Valis by a guy called Todd Machover, who is, I think he was trained at the Conservatory of Music in New York. So it shows just how powerful Phil's ideas were. But for me, the interesting thing about Philip K. Dick is the way his life reflected his novels and vice versa, in the sense that a lot of what he wrote about, I believe he actually experienced, which makes him particularly interesting. Sadly, we lost him too early. I mean, he died in his early 50s, which is very, very sad.
Yeah.
You know, it was a great loss to everybody, really. You know, he died in March 1982 at far too young an age. But again, having written a biography of him, the one thing I've discovered is that in those few years, he crammed in such an amazing life. You know, five wives, for instance, is just one example of the kind of things he got up to. But on top of that, he lived through a very, very important period of American history. You know, born in 1928, he lived through the Second World War as a youngster, and then through the 50s, and then through right into the trendy period of the 1960s and being in California in 67, 68. You know, he was there. He was witness to a great deal. And this comes across in his novels as well.
Indeed. Now, should we run through just some of the films that he's inspired? I don't know if you want to I certainly can do that. I have a list in front of me here. But do you want to talk about the films a little bit?
Yes, in terms of the movies, he has a whole series of movies being based upon Phil's work, some directly, some indirectly. But his most famous movie, of course, is Blade Runner, which was based on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? which was made into an absolutely iconic movie back in the early 1970s. But also before that, you had the Arnold Schwarzenegger film of Total Recall, which of course was recently remade again with a new version of that. But there are other movies as well. You know, you have
Confessions d'un Bardo. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that.
French film.
French film. Screamers. Minority Report. Paycheck. A Scanner Darkly. Next. Radio Free Albemuth. The Adjustment Bureau. Total Recall. The new one there as well. So it's quite a bit. And as you said, some of them have just been like, you know, short stories, and some of them have been kind of the full-on, you know, concept basically brought down to film format. But it's amazing, though, how many stories and the variety of those stories as well, really.
Well, one of the things, yeah, that's amazing when you for instance, you look at some of the movies that have been made in recent years in his work, something like A Scanner Darkly, the Richard Linklater, effectively, that is the most amazing movie because it really gets to the heart of exactly what Philip K. Dick was about. And I always advise people that if you want to go to see a movie that really does a credit to what Phil was about, the Scanner Darkly is the movie, because it deals with so many of the themes, the idea of what is reality, what is personality, how do we know who we are. I mean, effectively, the central idea of A Scanner Darkly is a breakdown of somebody's personality into multiple personalities. And, you know, the idea of people breaking, the way psychology breaks down. He also discusses in that drugs as well. And, of course, one of the major things about A Scanner Darkly was that it was very much based upon experiences that Phil had in the late 1960s, early 1970s in California. So a lot of the events that he describes in that novel, and indeed are described in the book, actually took place. And the characters were actually real characters he knew on the streets of California. But of course as well, you know, we've even got the latest work. I mean, for instance, I'd really like to mention here a friend of mine, John Alan Simon, who is the director of the making of Radio Free Albemuth, which effectively is one of Phil's most intriguing novels. So again, you know, we have so much there. But of course there are films as well that clearly have been based upon Phil's work. And I mean, I think, for instance, of The Truman Show.
Yeah.
In The Truman Show, we have the idea of somebody who believes that he's living an independent life, whereas the reality of the matter is that he's in a TV show, you know, and he's the main actor in a main character in a TV show. So again, these are things again that were profoundly important for Phil. But you know, from what you were just saying a second ago, when we were discussing, you know, off recording, I hadn't realised that they're now actually doing a new version of Blade Runner. Which is interesting.
Yeah, I know. It was statements made by Ridley Scott. He was he's working on something right now. They for some reason he seems to have a tendency. He always wants to do something new. He can't be related to previous projects. As the same with the Alien and Prometheus kind of thing. They loosely connect, but nonetheless, it was more or less they admit that it is going to be a sequel to Blade Runner, and Hampton Francher, one of the scriptwriters, I think he's part of writing it as well. So that's going to be very interesting to see where they take that. And again, if they can actually keep that true to some of, you know, Philip's original ideas, we'll see.
Well, that's going to be intriguing, because one of the major criticisms, if one can criticise such an iconic movie, because effectively the visuals were just simply fantastic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And as a movie, it worked on so many different levels. In fact, you may or may not be aware of this, but Phil didn't live to see the completed movie. But what he did do, he was given a screening of one of the trailers, and when he saw the image of the replicant Rachel in her really classical kind of 1940s style, he very much said that was exactly how he imagined the replicant Rachel would look. So Phil did say that in many ways the designers had got into his head. But sadly, he didn't live long enough to see it. Now, also, one of the most curious things about it is that Phil, in the novel, never uses the term Blade Runner at all.
That's right, yeah.
And also, the character, Deckard, in the story is very, very different to Deckard, the character in the movie, in the sense that Phil always used to write about the little man dealing with big events. You know, he very much had this concept of the journeyman, the person who was done upon rather than made things happen. You know, so effectively, you know, that this is the most important thing, really. When you look at, for instance, Minority Report, the movie, another movie that was based upon Phil's work, the Tom Cruise character in there is so totally antithetical to the character in the short story,
right?
You know, who was hopeless. You know, he was nagged by his wife. Everything in his life went wrong. And of course, one of the other things about Blade Runner that I think is very, very sad is that, of course, it was based upon the short story Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And the reason why it had such a curious title was that one of the main themes of the book was that Deckard himself was wanting to earn money in order to buy himself a real sheep, because in the world they lived in, that had been effectively destroyed, the environment had been destroyed by nuclear war, to own a real genuine animal was of profound importance. In fact, it's hinted upon very, very slightly in the movie.
It is, but in the shape of an owl in that case.
Yeah, yep. In the shape of the owl, and also in the shape of all the little creatures. You know, when they go inside
find
this little guy who's been building these little automatons.
Yep.
And of course, that's to do again with the central theme, because of course, whether you have enough money to be able to own a real sheep that you can have on the roof of your house rather than an android sheep. And of course, the other thing that was central to the book, which is completely missed in the movie, is the religious aspects, because central to the story is something called Mercerism, which is a religion. And people have these empathy boxes which they actually plug into, and they watch on television this character called Mercer who's having stones thrown at him and is suffering. And of course, the central theme of that, the whole movie as well, is empathy. The idea, you know, the one thing, the void camp test, which the androids have to take, is to see whether they're empathetic or not.
Yeah.
You know, and because they fail to show empathy, which proves that they're not human. But of course, you know, we have other characters in it that clearly are not, have no empathy either, and they are human beings. But I'd be interested to see where Ridley Scott would take it, because effectively he can't use anything from Philip K. Dick, so he's going to have to take something completely new and take the Deckard character further.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't, you know, seen the first movie or, again, want to rewatch it and don't remember whatever, but the hint there was that Deckard, of course, was an android himself in the movie. And I think Ridley Scott picked up on that in the second and was going to run on that more. So, but again, it's also what's interesting here. I don't want to run ahead in any regard, but it's interesting to see that the development, I mean, where is it, at least in the movie, it takes place in L.A. in 16 or 18 or something like that?
Yeah.
And I mean, in all seriousness, the development right now of the androids, of the robotics, of all things synthetic and artificial we're practically there soon, you know?
That's it. And again, you know, sort of as an aside here, one of the themes that Phil, from some of his very early short stories, was interested in the idea of, if you were an android, would you know that you were an android?
Right.
Could your memories be created? And of course, there's a very famous section in the movie Blade Runner where when Deckard is talking to Rachel about her memories, and he turns around and he says that, do you remember when you were a little girl, there were all these little spiders and they built a web overnight, and the next morning, you know, the there were all these little baby spiders that had actually come out. Now, he turns round to Rachel and says, they're not your memories, they're implants of your creator's niece. And of course, that's the point about Phil's work, you know, that how would you know that somebody had put all your memories in your mind 10 minutes ago? You would not be able to tell, you know, because the reason we define ourselves as to who we are is from our memories. Now, of course, again, you get a similar theme in Total Recall, because you recall in that the character, the Quaid, actually is can't afford to go on holiday to Mars, so he actually buys and has implanted into his mind the memories of the holiday.
Yeah.
Now, again, in one of Phil's earlier short stories, The Electric Ant, which is actually now being made into a fantastic Marvel comic, by the way, if you ever managed to get hold of it, the Electric Ant, the whole central point of The Electric Ant, is a guy who realizes that he's in fact an android, and he opens up his own chest and finds inside his chest a machine that looks a little bit like a reel-to-reel tape recorder. And he starts to move one of the reels of the tape recorder, and his perceptions of reality starts to speed up. And he realizes that this machine is what's creating his universe and his perceptions, and it's inside him. And, of course, this is one of the central points of Gnosticism, which, of course, again, we can touch upon. Phil was fascinated by Gnosticism. You know, the idea of, you know, again, what is reality? You know, how do we know that the reality is external to us or whether it's internal?
Well, it's very interesting. I want to talk a little bit more about obviously where he gets his stuff from. As you said, there is already a component in theology or ideology here, an interest in Gnosticism, but there is a history of drug use, obviously, but there's more to it than that. That he was tapping into some pretty extraordinary stuff for some reason. Now tell us about this. What you think that is at the backdrop of how he's managed to pull out so many just off the wall stories that at the same time then seem to be in many regards actually where we are heading technologically wise with the surveillance state with. I mean, there's so many components to it that just is mimicking the path that we're on, unfortunately. But what do you think? What's going on?
Well, I think that there are various factors here. I mean, one of the things that Philip K. Dick was very much a man of his time, you know, and the period he grew up, he was always involved on the periphery of left-wing politics in the Berkeley area in California. And indeed, he puts down the story that the reason that he was kicked out of university was that he refused to be involved in some military drills that they used to do there. There are various variations on that story. But effectively, you know, when he married his first wife, his second wife, Cleo, I mean, Cleo was very, very politically active with the American Communist Party. So Phil was aware of the fact that they were. Both Cleo and Phil were actually monitored by the authorities. In fact, there's a curious aside here. In fact, he was taught to drive by an FBI agent that was supposed to be monitoring what he was up to. But they actually became quite good friends. But Phil himself was very much an intellectual. You know, from a very early age, he was a fantastic reader. And he read voluminous amounts of philosophy and literature and such like. You know, for instance, I know that he absolutely adored the writings of James Joyce, for instance, you know, and he was very intrigued with that. But he was also interested in psychology, psychiatry, and lots of other philosophical concepts. So all these concepts were wound into his novels and into his books. Now, what is intriguing is that many, many people think that Phil started developing the deep philosophical ideas when he was older. But that was not the case. I mean, he was writing some fairly deep philosophical stuff when he was quite young. I mean, I'm reminded of the novel, let's go back to a novel, The Eye in the Sky, for instance, which he wrote in 1955 and was published in 1957. And in this, you have a group of individuals who end up existing in created worlds of the other characters and how they can survive that and the difficulties they have with that. So he was writing deep philosophical concepts very, very early on. But as he got older, he read more and more, and he wove them into his science fiction stories. But one has to remember that Phil wrote huge amounts of stories, because he had to, because unusually for science fiction writers at the time, Phil had no other income. He worked for a short period of time in a record store in California, in San Francisco, but he lost that job fairly early on, and from then onwards, the only income he had was from his writing. And he used to just write short stories, short story after short story after short story. And what he did was he rewrote the ideas in many, many ways and played around with them. And you do find certain themes come through in all his books because he had to recreate the ideas in different stories. And sometimes you'd get a short story which would mutate into a novel. And that happened many, many times. But Phil himself, what he really wanted to do was to be a serious mainstream writer. I mean, a lot of people forget this if they first are introduced to Phil's work. Phil didn't see himself particularly as a science fiction writer. He saw himself as a speculative fiction writer, but he also saw himself as a proper novelist. And for many, many years, he wrote serious novels. It's just nobody wanted them. You know, effectively, right. They would take his normal novels, but anything that he wrote that was what we would call serious, the people were not interested in them. You know, and some of his serious novels work very, very well. You know, and particularly, you know, today we're used to postmodernist novels and different viewpoints of characters and everything else, and novels that don't develop in a chronological way. And Phil was doing this in the late 1950s. The trouble is nobody wanted to know about it, you know, and I'm reminded of brilliant novels like Confessions of a Crap Artist. You know, it's absolutely superb. And that indeed was the only mainstream novel that was published in his lifetime. Whereas he wrote, you know, quite a few others, but they've only been published subsequent to his sad death. But he also, I believe, wrote from his own experience, because throughout his life, he had some very, very strange things happen to him. You know, and it seems to me that he himself was trying to understand how it was that a lot of his novels that he wrote when he was younger, he subsequently discovered the information for. Now, I need to sort of expand on what I mean by that.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that he would write a novel. Give an example, Ubik, which he wrote around about 1968. Now, in 1974, he had what he called his theophany, which was a series of very, very curious events. Some people saying he was having a mental breakdown. Other people turned around and said that it's because he'd taken Sumatoma too many drugs, which again is one of the rumors that go around that Phil was a real LSD freak. Now, I can only find evidence that he probably took LSD three or four times in his life. There were other drugs that he took. He took amphetamines and various other things. But he wasn't as big a drug fiend as he'd like to believe. But effectively, when he had this, what he called his theophany, his 2374, as he termed it, and 2-3 just means February and March 74, mm-hmm. when these events started to take place, he found that a lot of the things that happened to him, the things he understood, he found were in his earlier novels. Like, for instance, in September 1974, he wrote a letter. He was a great letter writer. And he wrote a letter to a lady called Claudia Krenz Busch, who was a postgraduate student that he became his pen pal. And he said, "I've just finished rereading Ubik for the first time since I wrote it, circa 1968. And I found that a number of my post-March dreams are absolutely for sure scenes from the book, down to the very last detail. If I had a better memory, I'd have realized it sooner. Well, all I can say is that I said, there's an airtight and super close relationship between Ubik, Philip Dick, and my post-March experiences. I don't know what I can add, but I'm sure I can think of something. In a way, the dream I cherish the most is the one which I carefully memorized." Now, what he's effectively saying here is the dreams and the images he had post-1974 were the things that actually created his earlier novels. Mm. Now, in order to explain this, and indeed the events of 1974, what Phil did was he wrote something that's now been known as his exegesis. And this was a series of initially handwritten notes and then typed notes, hundreds of thousands of words, which were actually published most of them were published in a book that came out around about 18 months ago called The Exegesis of Philip K. Dick. Now, in these, they're just disparate notes and observations and everything else. But one of the things he became particularly interested in at that time was something called orthogonal time, what he calls orthogonal time. And by orthogonal time, what he actually means is that there is linear time, which is the time that we all live in, you know, where, you know, we just perceive time flowing past us and the future's yet to happen. Then we experience the present and the present becomes the past.
Yeah.
Now, what Phil suggested is that there is another form of time, which he called orthogonal time, that actually moves off at right angles from every moment of our existence. Now, in this, I'm reminded, although Phil never actually mentioned it in any of his writings, in fact, there's a British writer or an Anglo-Irish writer called John William Donne, who in the late 1920s wrote a book called An Experiment with Time. And Donne came up with similar ideas to this. And basically what Phil is saying is that there is another time that exists where it's a permanent presence. And if you're located in that time, you can perceive all time as a present moment. And he argues that certain elements of our own personality or our subconscious or something, part of us, exists in orthogonal time. And if that is the case, it means that under certain circumstances, we can access future memories. And Phil argues that he was able to access his future memories, and in doing so, subliminally and unconsciously, used his future memories to write his earlier novels. Now, this is an intriguing idea. And he cites evidence of this. Like, for instance, one of his novels, in 1970, he wrote a novel called Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. And he'd argued that most of that novel appeared to him in dreams that he had at the time, while he was writing it, or as he was building up to writing it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was after he'd written the book that he started to find himself living the events that he described in the book. For instance, in the book, he has a character called Kathy, totally fictional character, who is a drug dealer and really dodgy character. And in the novel, he describes that Kathy had had an affair with a police officer. And in the novel, he describes that the police officer always used to wear a grey coat. Okay? Now, in 1971, when Phil was between marriages, he lived quite an interesting lifestyle, and he befriended a lot of street kids, and he had an open house, and people used to come in, and he used to take drugs, and God knows what else. And one of the girls that was involved in this group, now remember this is after he'd written Flow My Tears, the policeman said, there's a character in it, and one of the girls, she's called Kathy. Now, Phil gets friendly with Kathy, and in fact, he if you read his letters, he actually fell in love with Kathy as well. And Kathy is exactly the same as the character in Flow My Tears. But there was one day when Phil and Kathy were out on the town, and they were about to go into a bar. And as they went into the bar, Kathy goes, "Oh, we can't go in there." And he said, "Why?" And she said, My lover's in there." And he said, "Why are you nervous?" And she said, "Because he's an undercover cop." And Phil then looked over and saw the guy in the bar, and he was there wearing a grey coat. He was sitting there wearing the grey coat. And immediately Phil goes and thinks to himself, "But just a minute, this is a situation that I wrote in an earlier novel." Now, this happened to him many, many times. This is not a unique event. This happened quite a few times. Again, if you read my book, The Man Who Remembered the Future, I cite example after example of this. I mean, there were other scenes from his books, you know, that just happened to him after it, as if he was in some way back creating his novels from his future experiences. Now, he argued that if the orthogonal time idea is correct, then there is something in his life communicating backwards in time to him. And he decided that the entity that was doing this was something that he initially called Ubik, and then turned out and called Valis, which is, again, one of the major themes of one of his novels.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And this is a kind of a consciousness that either it's an alien consciousness that's beaming from outer space, as he argued, or whatever. But when he had his events in 1974, he felt that something had manifested inside himself, that he had effectively become two people. And this other part of him was all-knowing, and it knew everything about him. And in fact, this being, when it took him over, started to make him realize that he needed to get his act together. For instance, in one of his letters, he explains that the entity itself actually made him go out and buy a pair of clippers for his nose because he had nasal hair. And this thing said, you've really got to tidy yourself off. You've got to go out there and cut your nasal hair. Now, but this gets more intriguing. Because if you start to really look at this and you start to read Phil's life, there are two or three events that took place when he was very young that screamed out at me. And one of the events, for instance, was that when he was at school, he was doing his exams, I think it was for the entry to Berkeley University. And he was in the school hall. And he had great difficulty in remembering a particular formula or a particular process in physics. And I think it was the calculation of the displacement of water. And he couldn't remember it. And suddenly, out of nowhere, a voice comes into his head and explains it to him. And tells him exactly what to do and what to write. Now, he describes this, and again, if anybody wants to check this out, he describes this to Greg Rickman, who was one of his biographers. And Rickman interviewed him in October 1981, and this is when he describes this particular event. Now, this to me sounds as if Phil's future self was trying to help his past self to pass an exam.
Right, yeah.
Now, it then gets stranger and stranger. Because in October 1977, Phil did a radio interview with a guy called Richard Lupoff. Okay, it was broadcast in November of 77 and subsequently appeared in an article in August 1987 after he died in a magazine called Science Fiction Eye. And he makes a revelation about an incident that took place in 1951. Now, I'll read what he says. This is what he says in the interview. Back at the time I was starting to write science fiction, I was asleep one night and I woke up and there was a figure standing at the edge of the bed looking down at me. I grunted in amazement and all of a sudden my wife woke up and started screaming because she could see it too. She started screaming, but I recognized it and I started reassuring her, saying that it was me that was there and not to be afraid. Okay. He then says, within the last 2 years, I dreamed almost every night that I was back in that house back in 1951 or 52, the time that I saw my future self, who had somehow, in some way we don't understand, passed backward during one of my dreams, now back to that house, going back there and seeing myself again. So there really are some strange things. So what he's saying is that he had a dream. And in the dream, he's standing at the end of his bed looking at his younger self in 1951 or 52. But he then remembered the fact that in 1951 or 52, he woke up and saw himself standing at the end of the bed, an older version of himself. So here we have this interesting idea of, in dreams, him going back into his own past. Now, we have to take into account, of course we do, that Philip K. Dick was a science fiction writer, and I know from reading virtually everything that's been written about him, including all his letters in the research for my book, he did embroider things. And it would be very, very way of embroidering things. But to me, there's more to this than that, because
right.
It happened too often.
Right.
So it suggests to me that, and in my first book, Is There Life After Death, I don't know if you recall, but I suggest that we are made up of two personalities, the daemon and the eidolon. And the daemon effectively is your immortal self, for want of a better term. The you that has lived your life before many, many times. In fact, in my latest books, I very much use the analogy that we're living in a computer game, a computer simulation. And the computer simulation, we run through it many, many times, as you do if you play a first-person shooter game or an RPG game,
yeah,
where effectively, you know, your character on the screen runs down a corridor, gets killed. You then remember the fact as the game player that she shouldn't run down that corridor, and the next time you play your game, you run down the next corridor. But of course, the sprite on the screen doesn't remember the fact that she's lived before, but you do. The sprite on the screen is your Eidolon. That's the part of you that lives in linear time.
Yeah.
The daemon, the game player, lives in what Philip K. Dick would call orthogonal time. He's the game player. He's played the games many, many times, and he knows what's going to happen next. And I think this was what was happening with Phil. I believe that when Phil split into two personalities during his experience of 1974, effectively his daemon became imminent in his life. And the creature that he calls Valis or Ubik was, in point of fact, his daemon. And his daemon therefore starts to guide him. But in fact, his daemon had been with him for most of his life. I'm reminded, for instance, about one or two other very, very curious precognitions or written precognitions he had. For example, in the fall of 1960, Phil's third wife, Anne, had an abortion. They'd already had one daughter, Laura, who'd been born in February, and Anne fell pregnant very, very quickly. And Anne already had three daughters from a previous marriage, and really they couldn't afford to have another child. But Phil was very keen to have the child, but Anne went out and, against what Phil wanted, had an abortion. Now, again, the intriguing thing is that in 1959 into 1960, Phil wrote one of his mainstream novels called The Man Whose Teeth Were All Exactly Alike. And in this, there's a character called Sherry D'Ambrosia. And this woman has an abortion and doesn't tell her husband. And the husband gets very distraught about this. Now, this was, again, a year before Phil actually himself experiences the trauma of having a child aborted by his wife. Now, again, one could say, well, you know, that's, you know, it's just something he wrote about. But it's an intriguing point that he decided to write what in those days was an incredibly contentious thing. You know, we're talking about the late 50s, 1960s in America, and he was writing about something that powerful. Now, and the final one I'd like to just point here, because this one also intrigues me, is that when Phil had his theophany, the reason, what he claims stimulated it, and again, if anybody's interested, again, there's a comic called The Religious Experience of Philip K. Dick, which describes this, if you want to read it in comic format, by Robert Crumb. But Phil argued that his whole, the experience that took place in 74 was stimulated by a young woman calling at his door, and she had round her neck one of the ichthus, you know, the fish sign that Christians were.
Yeah.
And he claims that the sunlight hit this pendant that the young girl was wearing, and a pink beam came out, and it blinded him. I'll touch upon what really happened later, but that's the story he tells. Now, that happened again in 1974, March, February of 74. In 1962, Phil wrote a novel called The Man in the High Castle. In fact, many people consider this to be probably his best novel, in the sense it won the Hugo Award, so it was obviously recognized by his peers as being a great novel. I won't go into detail about it, but it's well worth reading as a novel anyway. But what is interesting is that one of the central characters of the novel is a guy called Mr. Tagoma. Tagomi. And Tagomi is a Japanese guy who's living in occupied West Coast America, because the Japanese win the Second World War in this alternate history. And Tagomi, Phil has Tagomi go, we're walking out one afternoon, and he sits down in a square somewhere in Los Angeles. And as he does so, he's bought this little silver carving. And as he looks at it, the light flickers from it and goes into his eyes. And it brings about a complete change in the way he perceives reality. In other words, what happens with Togomi is the light blinds him, and then he suddenly sees our California in the 1960s, rather than the California he was living in his alternate world. And for a split second, he glimpses the reality behind the reality. Now, this was in 1962. It was 12 years later when Phil had exactly the same thing happen to him. And he was blinded by the pink light. And that, he claimed, changed his whole worldview. Of course, there is an aside story to this, which it's important I do state. During my research in the book, I had a lot of help from many people, but no more so than Tessa Dick, who was Phil's fifth wife, final wife. Yeah. And Tessa was fantastically helpful, and we had lots of long Skype conversations on what happened to Phil, particularly during 2374. And Tessa's version is quite different. Tessa, for instance, says that what happened was Phil went to the door. The girl was at the door. She was delivering some drugs for Phil because he just had surgery for an impacted wisdom tooth. And Phil was staring at her breasts. And when Tessa came to the door with him, he realized that Tessa had grokked the fact that he was looking at her breasts and decided to make up a story because he was a bit of a lech. He liked women and women liked him. So, you know, that was typical of Phil. What then happened, Tessa said, was he turned round and it was early evening and sun was shining through the window, the opposite side of their apartment in one of the bedrooms. And on the window of the bedroom, Tessa and Phil had stuck a car sticker, a transparent car sticker, again of the fish sign. And what had happened was, and it was pink, and the sunlight had come through the fish sign and actually come out and had hit Phil in the eye. So it was slightly more prosaic than some kind of beam from outer space that just hit him and opened up his mind.
Right, yeah.
It was actually a sunbeam. Now, I take Tessa's word for that because I tend to apply Occam's razor to these things, and usually the most simple solution is normally the correct one. And I'm more likely to believe that what happened was that the light came in that way, rather than the way Phil describes it.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, it doesn't take away from the fact that something very peculiar happened to Phil at that time. And a final one, in terms of precognitions, which I really cannot let go, is his prediction of his own death, which is very, very curious. In that, in July 1980, one of the things I did when I researched the book is I read all his letters. And I'd like to thank my friend Nick Buchanan for loaning me a lot of his book, a lot of the very rare books that have been written on Phil. So thanks for that, Nick. Without him, I couldn't have done it. But in one of the letters, in a letter in July 1980, he wrote a letter to Russ Galen, his agent in New York, who actually he never met, which is quite amazing. And he was going on about his precog talents. This is what he called them. He actually called them his precog talents. So by this stage, Phil himself was convinced he was a precog.
Right.
Which is a term he used in many of his novels. Okay. And he said in the letter, "I'm discerned that I could very soon die of a stroke from high blood pressure. At this point, my precog talent, which normally operated on the margins of my conscious mind, is taking full control and is assuming full volitional power of my motor centers." In other words, it surfaced. Okay? Mm-hmm. So he's now feeling, he's sensing that he's likely to die of a stroke. Okay. This is 1980. This was in 1980. Less than 2 years later, Phil does die effectively of complexities due to a micro stroke. He'd had a series of what's called transitory ischemic attacks in his brain. And they think that's what actually killed him, which is brought on by high blood pressure. So in some subliminal way, Phil had sensed this. Then in September 1981, he died in March 82, he writes this. "I have," in his exegesis, "I have sensed for a while that I am dying, yet I'm not physically ill, but I become more and more tired, and where I feel it's in my legs, I feel there's so much to do to be told in my writings, to write about Christ and Krishna and God." Then December 81, he writes a letter to somebody called Sherry. and he makes another really odd statement. He says, "Am I trying to stave off death like the knight in the seventh seal? I am playing a chess game with death, and death will win. But in the meantime, I want, I don't know what." Okay? Mm. But then things then go from strange to very, very, very weird. In February 1975, Phil wrote a letter to Gloria Krenz Bush. This is, again, the lady I've mentioned, his pen pal. And I've got a copy of the letter,
mm-hmm.
and it's typed. But underneath, in a postscript, Phil has written the following. It's a general letter, but underneath, and he says, "I was up at 5 a.m. on this last night. I did something I never did before. I commanded the entity to show itself to me. The entity, by the way, is what I consider to be his daemon. It's this being that was manifest in his life." So going back to his quote, "The entity which has been guiding me internally since March. A sort of dreamlike period passed. Then, of hypnagogic images of underwater cities. Very nice. And then a stark, single, horrifying scene. Inert but not still, a man lay dead on his face in a living room between a coffee table and the couch." Okay?
Mm.
I subsequently have contacted Tim Powers, who was one of Phil's closest friends. And Tim was one of the people who found Phil unconscious after his stroke. Okay? This is how Tim Powers describes the scene as they broke Phil's door down. "When I got to Phil's place, the paramedics and Mary Wilson were already there, and the paramedic had lifted him from between the coffee table and the couch and carried him to his bed."
Wow.
Now, Phil died about a week or so later. People claim he didn't regain consciousness. In fact, he did. Now, that is inexplicable. There is no possibility in my mind other than that is absolute proof powerful that Phil saw the circumstances of his own death in an out-of-the-body state as he was hovering over his dying body.
Very interesting. Now, how come, do you think, Anthony, he had this bleed over, if we can call it that, the communication between the Eidolon and the daemon, or his past and future self? Is this a mistake that happens haphazardly, or could he control this in any regard?
I think it could be part of a cocktail of vitamins he was taking at the time. He had become fascinated by the split brain operations of Michael Gazzaniga and Roger Sperry. And he'd read the stories. But what happens is that when people have intractable epilepsy, epilepsy starts usually in one part of the brain, the focus point, the focus, and it spreads then across the brain. Now, if you can stop that storm spreading across the brain, you can stop somebody losing consciousness. Okay? And people usually use consciousness when the storm goes from one hemisphere of the brain, crosses something called the corpus callosum, which is a kind of a thick body that holds the two sides of the brain together. It's a bundle of nerves. The electric impulse goes from one hemisphere of the brain to the other and makes somebody lose consciousness. And of course, that's very dangerous if they lose consciousness. Sperry and his associates realized that the one way of actually stopping this happening was that if you cut the corpus callosum, you stop the signal going from one hemisphere to the other. And in the 1950s and 1960s, this thing, I think it's called a commissutomery, they did a series of operations where they cut the corpus callosum of young people or people with intractable epilepsy. When they did so, they were surprised to discover that they effectively created two people. So suddenly there wasn't one person in the brain, there were two. And there were times when they actually managed to communicate with the other entity that inhabited the non-dominant hemisphere of the brain. And now, of course, we know that the way that different sides of the brain work, there's subtle differences in the way that they function. And of course, one of the major issues is that ordinarily the non-dominant hemisphere is not vocal, because the vocal area of the brain tends to be in the dominant, usually the left hemisphere of the brain. I think it's either Wernicke's area or Broca's area. I think it's Broca's area, where the where speech is generated. So therefore, the non-dominant hemisphere usually cannot speak. But there have been cases, unusual cases, where they have been able to speak as well and communicate directly with these two individuals. Now, Phil became fascinated by this, and he had read, and I can't remember the name of the writer now, but there was an article that was written in Scientific American, and this guy had said that if you take certain mixtures of prescription drugs, you can facilitate the breaking down of your two sides of your brain. Now, on top of this, Phil would also have been fascinated by the writings of a guy called Julian James, who wrote a book called The Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind back in 1968, I think it was. Mm-hmm. I think it was 68. And I think you've interviewed on your show, haven't you, Marcel, is it Kleisters?
Yeah, Kujestein, I think his name is. Marcel Kujestein. Yeah, that's right.
Kujestein. So your readers will be very aware of the work of Julian James.
Indeed, yeah.
And so James had the idea that before we were unicameral, and effectively the voices we heard in our heads, we tended to consider to be the voice of the gods. Now, Phil was very taken by the work of Julian James as well. And when he was experimenting with these various ways of splitting his brain into two, he was intrigued that what subsequently happened was that the voice manifested inside his head, which was almost the opposite of what normally you would expect, because of course James said that it was because the brain became bicameral that we were able to realize that the voice inside our head is not the voice of God, whereas Phil was almost the reverse. He'd almost brought about his bicameralism, and by splitting the brain up into the two sections, he allowed the manifestation of this what I would call the daemon, the higher self. Mm-hmm. Now, if this is the case, this then makes for some intriguing discussions in terms of Phil, because suddenly this role of the being he called Valis suddenly becomes far more intriguing. Suddenly it is not just Phil making it up, but it's Phil experiencing something that a lot of mystics have experienced for centuries. You know, for instance, there has been an argument said that Phil had undiagnosed temporal lobe epilepsy. And in fact, again, if you read up about temporal lobe epilepsy, which is epilepsy focused on the temporal lobes, surprisingly enough, you will discover that temporal lobe epileptics, or as I prefer to say it, people who experience temporal lobe epilepsy, and I know there will be a lot of my readers out there who have contacted me, who listen to this show, who will be able to support me totally on this, is that individuals who have temporal lobe epilepsy manifest their daemon. And they realize they are two people and have this inner dialogue with their daemon.
And that's kind of a glitch, but it's an insight to how things really are, in a way, right? So
very much so. I mean, I think that what is happening here, I mean, to get more technical about this, is that what is happening is by this taking place, effectively what happens is you break down the doors of perception, as Blake called it, and Aldous Huxley discovered, you know, that you break down the doors of perception and you break round the human brain's work as what Henri Bergson would call an attenuator, the reducing valve of reality. And again, Phil discusses this in Exegesis, by the way, the idea that the human brain, in fact, stops us experiencing reality as it really is. And it is only during times of extreme stress or times when there's something neurologically odd about your brain that accesses the wider variety. And for instance, I'll cite this. I mean, one of the things I'm really intrigued, and if people have been following me recently on Facebook will know this, I'm absolutely fascinated by Charles Bonnet syndrome. And Charles Bonnet syndrome is where individuals start to see things that aren't there. And it's, my mother has had it. And there are other people I know who've actually had this experience. And funnily enough, again, if we get the chance to talk on this, one of the first things that started my mother on this point, she saw a UFO, which was diagnosed as being part and parcel of Charles Bonnet syndrome.
Yeah.
However, the interesting thing is that on Facebook, if you look at my Facebook page, there's a lady who actually saw the UFO my mother saw on the same day, exactly the same UFO. But what is weird is two or three nights later, my mother had an encounter with a grey. She woke up in the middle of the night and there was a grey coming around the door.
Mm.
And she phoned me up and she said, I don't know what happened last night, but I woke up in the middle of the night and I looked round and there was this little grey creature with huge black eyes and a slit for a mouth and long thin fingers. My mother was then in the 80s. She doesn't know ufology. She's got up on the backside. She doesn't know about flying saucers, but she described in absolute perfect detail a grey. And I think this is because her Charles Bonnet syndrome was breaking down the doors of perception and allowing her to experience the wider world, the world that people like Patrick Harper and people like Jacques Vallée, Passport to Magonia, people like John Keel, the individuals that say that there is a much wider reality here, and we perceive a very small area of this, a very small area of the electromagnetic spectrum. Now, again, one of the main things of Charles Bonnet syndrome is people see little children. My mother said this. She said she saw, you kept seeing little children running past her. Little children, little people, greys, piskies.
Now, is this a... How should we interpret that? Is that because that is a reality, that the similarities between the descriptions of these experiences is because that is the actuality of the fact, or do we explain it as it's, is it the manifestation of our, daemon that looks like that? Or what do you think?
No, I think in terms of this, again, you know, in my last talk with you, I discussed The Infinite Minefield, my last book. And in the second half, I'm going to be discussing a little about the pineal gland again with Phil.
Yep.
But for the moment, one of the things that is intriguing here is I think that what is taking place is that there are certain neurological events take place within the brain, and we know, for instance, that my mother now has Alzheimer's, and again, Charles Bonnet syndrome is a precursor for Alzheimer's and dementia, or particularly the form of dementia that my mother has, which is Lowy cell, the Lowy cells are actually causing problems with each other. I argue that what is taking place here is that the brain itself is moving away from the everyday perceptions and moving into a perception of the reality that shamans experience. You know, shamanic traveling, it's the place where people go when they lucid dream, it's the place that people go when they have out-of-the-body experiences, near-death experiences. And, of course, I'm reminded of the machine elves and Terence McKenna, and this whole idea of dimethyltryptamine released in the brain, it brings about these altered states of consciousness. Now, the general description of these things and the way in which materialist reductionist science explains it is simply to turn around and say, "Phew." It's an hallucination. It's labeling theory. We called it an hallucination, so therefore we pretend we've explained it.
Yeah.
I strongly suggest if anybody's interested, Oliver Sacks, who's a psychiatrist, has written a whole series of fantastic books, including The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and the Island of the Blind and various other books. His latest one is called Hallucinations. And funnily enough, the very first section on his book Hallucinations is about Charles Bonnet syndrome. And again, if you read that, he has a patient who has Charles Bonnet syndrome. And what she's seeing? Children. She's seeing little children everywhere. Mm-hmm. They're seeing greys. They're seeing archetypes. Now, the question is, if we say that these things are Jungian archetypes, that doesn't explain anything either. It's, again, labeling.
Yeah.
These archetypes have been with us for millennia. We know them as the little people, the fae, the fairies. These are the little people. The little people, the greys. It's all part of the same phenomenon. Say, Jacques Vallée, you know, Passport to Magonia. Magonia is the place that we can't normally perceive. You know, as John Keel said in Project Trojan Horse, you know, what reality is far more complex, and UFOs and entities that are perceived in DMT dreams, the machine elves, all these things are all aspects of the same phenomenon. It's just we interpret it differently depending upon how we access it. You know, what facilities allow us to access these things. And I'm very, very excited because, again, I'm finding myself joining dots that I never expected to be joining. You know, I don't mention Charles-Bonnet syndrome in any of my previous books. But by God, I'm going to be mentioning it now because I think this is a profound importance. And again, you understand, once you start to understand the neurology, you start to realize this is science. You know, there's nothing I'm saying here that is woo-woo in any shape or form. This is known neuroscience. And this is what is profoundly important about these things, is that I'm doing the science. I'm not pretending I'm channeling information from the planet Tharg or 50,000-year-old Atlantean priests are talking to me. No, I'm reading the science books and pulling the things together that way.
Very, very interesting. We have much more to talk about when it comes to Philip K. Dick and some of the experiences he had. And, just get into a little bit more about the Volus as well, the vast active living intelligence system, as he called it, and really what that is. And it's fascinating that you connected that with the daemon and how that would also explain some of the aspects that it's the experience that Phil had seemed to be very much. Certainly he had an insight into things that extend outside of his own interests, if you will, his own realm, but there are things primarily that speaks to him about his own life. As you said, these stories are very much recurrent of things that happened to him later and such. We'll get in more to that later, Anthony, but let's give out some of the details now. Of course, the book is A Life of Philip K. Dick, The Man Who Remembered the Future. You have a Facebook page set up, as you said, and it's simply facebook.com. And then the initials for the Man Who Remembered the Future, so TMWRTF. So facebook.com, TMWRTF. We'll have that linked up. But give us your other websites as well, Anthony, because you have a lot of books out there now. This is your seventh, I believe, right?
Yeah, it is. And in fact, I've just completed the eighth book, which I've written with Professor Irvin Laszlo, which Irvin and I have worked together on. And you're probably aware of the work of Irvin Laszlo. He's been
indeed,
quite,
yeah. Yep.
You know, twice nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, and that will be out next year, and it'll be published in the States first, unusually for my books. But effectively, all my books now have a Facebook site. If you just type in the title of the book, you will actually get onto the Facebook site as well. We're also trying to get started up again the forum, which is www.cheatingtheferryman.com. That's cheatingtheferryman.com, and a friend of mine, Stephen Bowman from Dublin, is now acting as the main man on that for me. But we need to get that discussion going again, because it has been in the past a very, very good area for people to discuss in depth my ideas and their own ideas. Because as I say, you know, this is not me. This is a much bigger movement than me now. In terms of my website, it's anthonypeake.com. That's Anthony with an H and P-E-A-K-E. And I also have, if you want to have a look on YouTube, there's now an Anthony Peake YouTube channel as well, which you can check out on.
All right, very good. AnthonyPeake.com. Check out the Facebook pages. We'll have links up to the latest material right there. Okay, stay with us. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back with more. Some of our upcoming guests: Terry Melanson, Amy Vickers, Patrick Henningsen, James Hall, Randall Carlson, David Talbot, Richard Dewhurst, and many more. You can find more at redicecreations.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our RSS feeds, and new shows, as soon as they are out, comes directly to you. Very convenient. We are going to proceed now with Anthony Peake in the second hour as we talk more about Philip K. Dick, about his alien abduction experiences, and his inquiring interest into the pineal gland and the spiritual areas connected with the awakening process. We'll also talk more about Valis, the simulacra that we're all living in, and also phylogenic memory, how packets of DNA activates our memory of our past, who we really are, where we come from, and what we are doing here. A very interesting continuation is coming up. You can acquire a membership for yourself or for a friend, a nice Christmas gift, by the way, and enjoy our full archives, all our programs, both ours, and you get access to videos, films, and commentaries as well. If you're joining us for the Members Hour as we continue, we want to say thank you for your support and for keeping us free from commercials. We'll be right back, so stay with us.